You are listening to a PERC podcast brought to you by the Property and Environment Research Center in Bozeman, Montana. As part of PERC's Lone Mountain Forum, Reconciling Economics and Ecology, PERC board member Stephen Hayward sat down with author Charles Mann to revisit contemporary understandings of the pre-Columbian world.
Well, hi, I'm Stephen Hayward here today at the Property and Environment Research Center in Bozeman, Montana with Charles Mann, who is the author of several fine books. One of my favorites is Noah's Choice about Endangered Species, and also one that's better known with a lot of readers, 1491, and its sequel, 1493. And Charles, let me start this way. I think it might be fair to say that you've done more than just about anyone in recent years to revise the popular view that Columbus represented the North American equivalent of the invasion of the Garden of Eden and the fall of the Edenic paradise, right? I wonder what larger lessons people should take away from studying the story more closely as you have.
Well, I'm flattered by your description. I would rather say that it's actually the combined work of all the anthropologists, archaeologists, ecologists, botanists, you name it, that I'm reporting on that have really done that to change it. And I've tried to put a bow on it and make it look nice for readers. But really what's happened over the last 30 or 40 years is that our conventional understanding, what I learned in school, what maybe you learned in school, that about the Americas were like in the first 15 or 20,000 years of human history in the Americas, have been completely changed. I mean, when I went to school, we learned that the Americas had been, Indians had walked across here about 12,000 years ago, which is not that long ago as these things go, that they lived for the most part in these small scattered bands, and that when they came, and when Columbus came here, they'd had so little impact on the environment that he, walked into what was, for all intents and purposes, a wilderness. And now we know that almost all researchers think that all three of these were wrong. They were here far longer than previously believed, in far greater numbers than previously believed, and they had far more environmental impact than previously believed, which means many things. I mean, both changing our understanding of our past, which of course changes our understanding of our present, but particularly for environmental issues, so many of our environmental laws are based on the idea that there's this baseline of 1492 with no human presence. And now we know that the ecosystems that we're all concerned about evolved with people in them, with people affecting them for thousands and thousands of years.
You just mentioned three of the sort of misconceptions of the old standard Columbian narrative, so to speak. Is it fair to say that a fourth one is that sort of pre-Columbian America was uncivilized, is maybe too strong a word, but in other words, you explain in your books, it seems to me, that there was very rich, advanced civilizations existing at the time.
I mean, the implication of the sort of what I learned in school, I mean, I wasn't smart enough to realize this when I was in school, but is that these people came here and then they didn't do anything for thousands and thousands of years. They're like these perfect Sierra Club tourists. They were sort of, living lightly on the land and taking only photographs if they had cameras and touching nothing. And these are unlike people anywhere else in the world. It's sort of saying that they weren't human. And in fact, they did what people all over the world did, which is build complex and interesting societies that had enormous impacts all around them. And so basically, what archaeologists and anthropologists, all these people that I've been talking about are saying is that these were human beings and they acted much like human beings elsewhere on the planet.
Well, one of the rich suggestions that I took away from 1491 is that, we think of this as the new world, but in fact, as you argue, this really could, in some ways, is the old world, and Europe is in some ways the new world.
Right. Much of northern Europe was, covered by ice for a long period of time. 10, 12,000 years ago, you couldn't live in England because there's these giant ice sheets on top of it, whereas the civilizations in Mesoamerica and in South America were flourishing. So, if you want to say those are old world and what, we think of, me being English as where I came from, that was a much newer place than these great civilizations down in South America and Central America.
You have a riveting narrative all the narrative is riveting, but one that especially I think is fascinating to me was the one about the role of disease brought over by European settlers and how massive was the die-off from all of that. That story, I think, is sort of generally known by a lot of people who know at least something about what took place. I'm also interested in, we know from the archaeological record that lots of these pre-Columbian civilizations collapsed on their own before any Europeans arrived.
Sure.
What were some of the leading causes of the ups and downs of the pre-Columbian civilizations?
But pretty much, you know, civilizations all over the world rise and fall. I mean, the Etruscans collapsed. You know, it was, you know, they did it on their own. The Hittites collapsed. You know, all these societies collapse. And they typically do it for a variety of reasons. But relatively low on that, the list of reasons, is environmental impact. Mm-hmm. Typically, they tear themselves apart through war, through civil war, through an unrest of all sorts. What's striking, and one of the more striking examples, that you know, it's human beings' own fault that they that their societies fall down. It has relatively little to do with nature coming in and you know, wreaking revenge.
Right.
It's a kind of story that you often hear, and the same thing is true with America, with the societies in Americas.
Right. Well, you and Emma Maris and a number of other writers have pointed out that there were large extinctions of large mammals in America, you know, 8, 9, 10,000 years ago, that mm-hmm. coincides with maybe the arrival of some of the of the new Americans, or maybe mm-hmm. they go back further right. What's some of the latest guesses as the causes of this? I know you talk about some people say they were actually hunted by the Native Americans. Some say maybe it was climatic or both. Or where do you come down on that?
It's a really interesting puzzle, and I think that the honest answer is nobody really knows. So what we're dealing with is theories, but there's no real solid answer that the majority of researchers in the field believe. What was held true for a long time was what's called the overkill hypothesis. And the overkill hypothesis is that this group of people, the Clovis people, came about 12,000 years ago, almost, you know, across the land bridge from Siberia, during this time when the when that was permitted, because there was so much water from the ocean had gone into the ice sheets that covered the land, and then they came through this magically appearing ice-free corridor, and just about that time, all these large mammals died, 32 genera of large mammals. And so the coincidence in time was irresistible, and people produced these computer models that showed that a small group of people could radiate out across the continent and wipe out all the mammals. Now the problem is that it's almost universally accepted that they're here for, you know, 17, 18, 19, maybe even 25,000 years. And so that would have meant that they would have been here for 12,000 years ago, then suddenly killed them all. And it's much harder to invent a mechanism for that. So the overkill hypothesis has fallen out of favor because the synchronicity in time, that was the main reason for believing it, has fallen apart. And so then what are you left with? Well, there's the idea that maybe it was disease. And disease is sort of, people wave their hands and sort of say, some kind of disease. And then there's climatic changes. But it's, again, very difficult to show other examples where climate had this kind of impact. There's another hypothesis, and there seems to be this tremendous tug and back and forth over it, that there was a near miss by some large kind of meteorite. And there's a huge fight over whether this layer of tiny impact stones that's at about 12,000 feet suggests this or not. Hmm. And so you're right at the uncomfortable intersection of geology and archaeology and so forth. And my guess is that this is following a pattern with the earlier fight about whether what turned out to be a giant meteorite impact that hit just north of Yucatan wiped out the dinosaurs. And there is a 20-year scientific battle about that. And I think we're in the earlier stages of a similar one over this. And my guess is that it might work out in the same way. But that's just a guess.
Sure. Are there other sort of large, outstanding questions in this area right now?
Huge ones. Yeah. I mean, you know, it would be very nice to know how they got here, for sure. Right now, the main theory is that they went by boat, but that's... The reason that they have that theory is that all the other theories seem to have been proven wrong. So this theory has at least the merit of not being wrong, but there's no real strong evidence for it. There's a very puzzling aspects of the settlement pattern. The oldest settlements we know of are at the tip of South America. Why is that? There's big questions, interesting questions about the amount of contact across the oceans that were there before. And those are fun to think about. They probably didn't have consequential impacts for the people. It would be interesting to know about how much of this kind of contact there were. And then there's lots of interesting stuff about what is the origin of Mesoamerican civilizations. There's a big argument now, scientific argument, I should say, debate about whether the Olmec were what they call the mother culture, or whether there is a whole kind of cultural explosion there where many societies arose at once. And then probably the biggest area, or two biggest areas of research that I'm following are, you know, what was really happening in the Amazon. And there's just an explosion of research there. It's really, really interesting. And then the same thing is true for the Pacific Northwest and British Columbia. Lots and lots of evidence that our picture of what was going on there was wrong. So it's a really interesting area, and I probably have to write another edition of the book soon.
Let me try out a perhaps wild thought experiment.
Okay.
Let's suppose that the pre-Columbian civilizations here had developed long-range sailing ships, and the flow of exploration was the other way. In other words, suppose that the people of the Americas had sailed to Europe before Columbus. What would have happened? Well, how would that have changed the unfolding of the whole globalization story that really is the theme of 1493?
I've actually thought about this question because it's, well, I guess it's just fun to think about. And there's two things to note. First is that Native people in the Americas did develop long-range sailing vessels. And, you know, one of the clearest examples of that is that the way that the Spaniards found out about the Inca is that they found an Inca ship. They captured an Inca ship that was off the coast of southern Mexico that had gone all the way from, you know, roughly where Lima is up there. So that's a pretty long distance. They had those ships. The Inca Empire was exploring, but it was on the wrong side of the ocean. You know, it was on the wrong side of the continent, right? They would have had to go across the Pacific, which is an enormously long way to contact somebody else. But suppose an Inca-like civilization had emerged, you know, on the other side, on the Atlantic side, and they go across. Now, the real answer is there are all these diseases waiting for them, and that would have been fatal. But pretend that they weren't, you know, or they were immune for some reason. And they could have done exactly what the Spaniards did. The Spaniards developed this kind of methodology of conquest, which is they would go and grab the king. And they developed this, you know, through the Caribbean, and then they went and did this exact same thing, both in the case of the Aztecs and in the case of the Inca. And these societies had, you know, these theologically important kings. They're grabbing a god, you know, or somebody who ruled by divine power, and there's a tremendous consternation when this happened, and this provided an entree for the Spaniards to seize control. Well, European societies were exactly the same. You know, the Sun King was ruled by divine right. I mean, so the fun thing to imagine is a party of 400 Inca coming in there. French would have said, "Whoa, look at this. This is amazing." They would have gone right up, and the king would have wanted to seize them. Suppose they had seized Louis XIV. The same thing with the total paralysis of the mechanism of state for months on end. And then finally they would have, you know, probably attacked them. But anyway, the Inca could have hijacked the French state or the British state or the Spanish state in pretty much the same way.
Right. I would have saved the British a lot of trouble around that time.
Exactly. Now, it wouldn't have worked because of the diseases, but it is certainly fun to think about.
Right. Charles, thanks very much for spending a few minutes with us.
To learn more about the Lone Mountain Forum, visit www.perc.org.